Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Forget 3D printing. What if every home had a box that could assemble DNA or even small organisms, assemble life? Craig Venter, who sequenced the human genome, has pioneered synthetic life creation. Now he's thinking wide about building life in a box at home, about biological teleportation, about the meaning of life itself when the capacity to design and deploy it rests in human hands. This hour on Point, Craig Venter on genetic science, synthetic life, and where it takes us. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What happens with life when we, humans, code it, design it, teleport it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from San Diego, California, is J. Craig Venter, president and CEO of the J. Craig Venter Institute and of Synthetic Genomics Incorporated. He famously led the private team that first sequenced the human genome, also the team that created what he calls the first synthetic life form in 2010. He received the National Medal of Science in 2008. Science journalist Lori Garrett calls him the richest, most powerful man in biotechnology. His new book is Life at the Speed of Light, From the Double Helix to the Dawn of Digital Life. Craig Venter, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
This is really fascinating stuff. It's kind of, I'm sure you found again and again, scary in some ways and quite thrilling in other ways. Maybe we can just dive in the deep end first and then paddle back towards some of the amazing applications you're talking about here. You write in the book, Craig, synthetic biology frees the design of life from the shackles of evolution. What do you mean?
Well, evolution has been a long, slow process over the last close to 4 billion years. Social evolution, for example, moves orders of magnitude faster. Just think of the changes in the last decade or so and how we adapt to new technologies like iPads and iPhones, just as an example. So instead of waiting for these slow changes to take place in our species and other species, we can take over evolution to change it to do things we need biology to do for humanity.
Take over evolution. And by that, you mean apply synthetic biology, synthetic life. What is it? How's it work? Describe it.
So we've been reading genomes now for a long time. My team read the first genome of a living species in 1995. 5 years later, as you said, we went on to sequence the first draft of the human genome. And when we read genomes, we're converting the A's, G's, and T's of the genetic code into the ones and zeros of the computer. And with synthetic life, we've tried to go the other direction. We start with the computer code, this digitized information, and four bottles of chemicals and rewrite the genetic code, rewrite the genome. And that's what we finally achieved after almost 10 years of effort in 2010 when we had the first cell that was totally controlled by chemically made DNA.
Describe what you did in 2010. This bacterium, you wrote the code, as you say. What was the basis for that code? And then you poured it into a kind of the hardware, the living cell. Describe what happened, what you did then.
So we started with two species of mycoplasma. These are small bacteria with just a plasma membrane, kind of like our cells have. And we removed the genome from one cell initially in 2007. And we worked out ways to transplant that into a recipient cell. The recipient cell we used was one about the same distance apart that we are from mice, around 10% or so difference in our genetic code. And as soon as we put this chromosome into the recipient cell started reading the genetic code, started making proteins. some of the proteins produced were actually these restriction enzymes that my friend and colleague in all this work, Hamilton Smith, discovered that led to his Nobel Prize in 1978. They're the scissors that cut DNA at specific points. They chewed up the chromosome that was already in the cell. So we had a body of one cell and the genetic software of another. In a relatively short period of time, that genetic software took over the cell and converted it into the species that the chromosome came from. So the notion is that we're a genetic software-based system, and when you change that software, you can totally convert one species into another.
So synthetic life, because you ended up with something that had not existed before. Of course, the genome was natural that you transplanted. The recipient was pre-existing. Just look at the genome side first. There you took something that created by nature and dropped it into a new recipient cell, I guess.
Well, that was the initial experiment.
Okay.
And then 3 years later, we went on, and so we took basically that same genetic code. It was Mycoplasma mycoides. Mm-hmm. We made a number of changes to it, but it was primarily the mycoides genome. We've never claimed that we've designed a new life form totally from scratch that never existed before. Of course, we're relying on the existing science and the existing evolution. But we made a number of changes to it to make it clear that it was the first synthetic species, including a number of watermarks where we can write the English language with numbers and punctuation into the genetic code. It was 1.1 million letters chemically made DNA. We put that into the recipient cell. That recipient cell started reading the synthetic DNA as it had done years earlier with the natural DNA. And made all the proteins coded for by that new DNA. Those proteins replaced all the proteins in the cell because the other software was eliminated, and it converted that recipient cell into everything that was coded for by the DNA that we put in the cell.
And with that, you're talking a lot now about digital biology, by which you mean you can take this genetic code, gather it, manipulate it on a supercomputer, and drop it into a recipient host, and off you go with a new organism.
Yeah, I think the key thesis of my book, Life at the Speed of Light, is that the DNA world and the digital world of the computer are becoming interchangeable. We can readily read the genetic code and digitize it in the computer. And now we've shown we can go the other direction. We can take the computer code and recapitulate the DNA code. And this is where, in fact, the book title came from, Life at the Speed of Light, because we can actually send that information at the speed of light, or we can send it through the internet as digital code and recapitulate it at the other end.
Which, I mean, you make conceptual leaps fairly easily, but not without a lot of background work here. The first one that you were talking about here is this kind of easy-bake life box you imagine one day, maybe in people's kitchens or garage, I don't know, and you could zap some code out to it, to some base material here, and it mixes up and produces a life form, be it a vaccine or you name it. That's the kind of life box in the kitchen you're talking about.
Well, it would be maybe like a printer attached to your home computer. And I think that the new concept is that, yes, we can download biology from the internet. Maybe that will be in the form of the insulin protein. If you're somebody with diabetes dependent on insulin, you can just download that from the internet to your home. Or maybe it'll be a new vaccine to stave off a new flu pandemic in the future. We already have one of these devices and in the automated form at our laboratories. And we have a manually operated one at the Novartis facility in North Carolina, their vaccine facility, so that All we have to do is send new digital information there from a sequenced emerging flu strain, and it can go right into production there to begin to make vaccines. And this will change the way we deal with pandemics in the future. It's just a question of how soon we can scale up to have a big impact.
You call it the digital biological converter. Current prototype for the U.S. Department of Defense's research agency, DARPA, 8 feet long, 6 feet high. And you've got what, a prototype test before the end of this year. You can sit somewhere else, type it in, and you expect it to mix up the life form you've asked for.
Yes, we talked about doing this on a C-130 or something to prove that it's just digital information going up to the aircraft. But I think the first test will probably be in the laboratories. But that's just testing the device as a separate device. Essentially, what we did in 2010 is a cruder version of that same experiment, because we started with the computer digital code. And once it's in the computer, you can send it anywhere in the world very easily.
Sounds like you imagine, I don't know how many decades from now, that being almost commonplace. They need XYZ vaccine in New Guinea. Send it off. It's there.
It could happen very quickly if we want it to. I think it's going to pose challenges for the regulatory parts of our government of how do you regulate the internet and how do you regulate what you download from it. Maybe you'll have to have a prescription for one of our boxes to download insulin the same way you would a prescription to go to the pharmacy. It's not clear how it will play out. The technology will be there to move biology around in the digital world.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about genetic science, synthetic life, and where it may take us with Craig Venter, pioneer in the first sequencing of the human genome and author of the new book, Life at the Speed of Light. He joins us today from San Diego, California. He's got big labs that are hard at work on all kinds of mind-blowing fronts here. Craig Venter, I wish you'd describe some of the applications of this synthetic life creation that you imagine that might be very useful, as you describe them, answers to some of our biggest challenges in this century. Like what?
So synthetic genomics, we're working on several fronts. We're working on increasing the lipid output of algae to eventually get it to the point where we could just get a fuel straight from sunlight and carbon dioxide.
So energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so energy is one. And it's an important example of how we have to change evolution. Because algae did not evolve to produce just huge amounts of lipid from sunlight. They produce lipids sort of the same way we do as a species. They store the energy as fat. So when the sun's not out, they have energy to burn. We want to change how they produce that, so they produce massive amounts that would never occur naturally. The ocean would be full of lipid, not water, if evolution went that direction.
So stop pumping oil, start pumping lipids, energy, yes. Energy-filled lipids, yeah?
Yeah, so that's, you know, that's going to take a while. We're creating a synthetic chromosome to do that. We've changed the efficiency of photosynthesis in algae. So that's one area. Another area is using the same approaches to produce new foods. There's three people on the planet for everybody that existed the year that I was born, in 1946. Mm-hmm. Soon there'll be five times what existed when I was born. We have trouble providing food, energy, medicine, clean water for the 7 billion people. We're going to really have trouble doing it for 10 billion people. So we need new approaches. And so producing a very healthy, balanced protein sources that can be allergen-free is one of the potentials to come from engineering algae cells. Also, they produce nice, healthy lipids like the omega-3 fatty acids.
We've seen these images, and maybe this isn't where you're going, but of what looked like synthetic life, sort of synthetic meat, you know, sort of hamburger in a box. Is that what you're describing? We would grow creatures or parts of creatures, flank steak, I don't know, or is this all plant-based protein, algae-based, or both?
No, it's a good question. A number of other people are taking the approach of trying to grow animal cells in culture to produce meat. I personally don't think that will ever work out. But we're trying to, in fact, take the proteins that are nutritious out of beef, chicken, fish, and we can produce those same beef, chicken, and fish proteins in algae or in yeast. Our somewhat facetious term for it is motherless meat,
okay,
where it will be even more nutritious than meat, the same flavor if you want, but without the animals being part of the process, because producing a kilogram of steak takes on the order of 20,000 liters of water, a massive amount of grain or feed,
mm-hmm.
and it's clearly not sustainable. And even though I like to eat steaks, I know it's not part of the sustainable future. So we're trying to come up with new food sources.
And it's not just algae.
They could
algae.
Be new sources of flour, for example. Go ahead.
It's not just algae you're talking about. You're writing about new ways to enhance, through synthetic life, this digital biology, enhance the human body as well, you write, such as boosting intelligence, adapting to new environments, rejuvenating worn-out muscles, and so on. Like what? How?
I don't recall about boosting intelligence, although if we could do that, that would be
fantastic.
Well,
I'm reading from your book here, sir.
I think the future therapy in humans is going to be stem cell therapy. But what we have shown is when you take stem cells out of the body, the genetic code starts to change fairly dramatically. It doesn't matter whether they're embryonic stem cells or iPS stem cells. So a key part of the future of stem cell therapy, which has a chance to play a major rejuvenating role in biology, is to correct the genetic code in those stem cells. So it's using the same technology we use for writing new code to correct the errors in human stem cells, where they can your stem cells can go back only without the accumulated defects, maybe from radiation and chemical exposure.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a much further way off than what we're talking about with trying to produce new foods, energy, and medicine. So, you know, the third area we're playing a major effort on is with developing new vaccine sources, like I talked about with the flu vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And Novartis has actually taken into production, the H7N9 vaccine that we worked with them to develop. And this was based on the outbreaks in China recently, earlier this year. A team of Chinese scientists sequenced the genome of the virus, posted it on the internet, and at the request of the U.S. government, we downloaded that sequence, made the virus. And for a long time, it was the only source that the CDC, the U.S. government and Novartis had of having the actual virus, because it's difficult to send these complex, very infective strains, you know, through the mail around
mm-hmm,
the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can just send them as digital information. And within 10 hours of getting it, we had produced the prototype virus for the flu vaccine. And so this is part of sending things as digital information and creating it on site. And so this is what's now being done in North Carolina. If there's a new flu outbreak, the second that a sequence is determined and posted on the internet, it can go right to the site and start producing the new vaccine. With the H1N1 pandemic, we didn't have a vaccine until 2 months after the pandemic had peaked. So we need faster ways to staff off infections. And with the population increasing and the rate of air travel around the world, new infections, as we've seen, will spread extremely rapidly. So this could be one way to head them off before they get too serious.
Send
we're
some,
also working.
Yes.
We're also working on new anti-infective agents. So there's now more people dying in the U.S. From antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections than from car accidents. Our antibiotics,
superbugs.
That basically medicine is sort of created by using a limited repertoire of antimicrobials because they were of an economic advantage to the pharmaceutical industry to have one drug that worked against multiple strains of bacteria. And that's helped lead to rapid resistance to these. We need pretty desperately right now new anti-infective agents to deal with, as you say, the superbugs. One way that we're trying to approach this is to go back to a technology that was being used in Eastern Europe before the discovery of penicillin, and that's these bacteriophage viruses that attack and kill very specific bacteria versus just attacking them all broadly. And early on, this was used to control infections. There's a number of groups in the U.S. now working on these, but it's the type of thing we could, again, send those through the internet to get the anti-infective agent to a place where it's needed very rapidly.
Send them through the internet, says Craig Venter, to be kind of brought to life at the other end in one of his digital boxes, digital bio boxes, and pretty soon you're essentially talking about biological teleportation. We'll look at that and a lot more. Craig Venter writes in his new book, Life at the Speed of Light, he is ready to rewrite the software of life, says the digital age of biology will drive evolution in radical directions. You hear some of the potential benefits right there. The mind goes to potential downsides as well. We'll look at that. Craig Venter, stand by in San Diego. I want to begin to bring our listeners in. Rick in Gaysmill, Wisconsin. Rick, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Craig Venter.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Venter. It's always extremely interesting and stimulating to listen to you and read you. My question, it sounds like everything that you're describing, you're going to be creating liquid, like liquid proteins. Is that correct? And will you create any solid material, or can that not be done? Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Dr. Venter.
Yeah, Rick, thanks for your comment and question. So obviously the biology itself works in a liquid phase, but these new proteins, the food substances, the algae itself can be dried down and made as flour and used for all kinds of different cooking purposes. The insulin obviously can be dried down and sent as a powder once it's produced, the same way that insulin is now, only in specific factories. So the biology can definitely go from the aqueous phase, the water phase, into a dry form, and a lot of the protein functions can be reconstituted just by adding water back.
How sophisticated could this get? I mean, can you foresee a time when you punch in the code and at the other end a, you know, baby gerbil pops out of the box, or is it all tiny one-cell, few-cell organisms?
Well, right now we're limited to proteins, to small bacteriophage or viruses, and to single-cell organisms. I'm not sure there would ever be the scientific or commercial demand for downloading gerbils. But I think the earlier inventors of the internet probably didn't foresee a lot of the uses that are going on. In theory, once you can regenerate DNA, you can recapitulate all life. It's going to be a long time before we get to easily moving the code for multicellular organisms and recreating them at the other end. But when you start with a bacterial cell, it's pretty straightforward. When you start with complex multicellular mammalian life, for example, you'd be starting over at the equivalent of birth with that mammalian life. So it's not true teleportation.
Not Star Trek style.
In the Star Trek style, exactly.
So if I teleport my producer, Sam, it's going to be baby Sam who shows up at the other end of the operation.
Or sperm Sam.
Okay. There's new rubric for Sam. Maggie in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Maggie, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. This is a fascinating and amazing discussion and science. I think it's so wonderful as a lover of biology studies and sci-fi. I really appreciate the level of understanding that Craig is giving at a layman level. It seems very easy to follow, and it's still miraculous. I did kind of extrapolate a little bit of the earlier discussion and thought, this sounds like at some point in the distant future, life might be able to be seeded, plant life for starters, on a distant, potentially habitable planet or moon. And,
Maggie, your line is so rough, but I think I got that, and I appreciate your call. I'm sorry for the rough line there. Craig Venter, Maggie is imagining something that you're writing about quite explicitly, that is teleporting life between planets or moons. You go particularly to the Mars example, which you say, yes, and let's do it pretty soon. What about that, Craig?
So, Maggie, thank you for your comments and your question. Yes, even though that it came from a Star Trek episode of the Genesis Project to seed new life somewhere else. I think that is in the cards for the future, although I believe that the more we look elsewhere, the more we'll find a life. And the Kepler Project that's discovered on the order of 100,000 Earths and super-Earths within our own galaxy, I think makes it very highly probable we will find life elsewhere. In my book, I describe sample return from Mars and how that's been a multi-billion-dollar problem because you have to get a rocket big enough to get up there to blast off and get back to Earth with samples.
This is the presumption that there is some kind of life on Mars, very simple, presumably, that we might gather, bring back on a rocket. And you're saying if there's life there, there's a better way to bring it back to Earth. What, how, why?
So there's been oceans probably at least two different occasions on Mars, the data's indicating. And we exchange about 100 kilograms of material each year between Earth and Mars. So
just flying around in space and bang into it, each of the
planets? Well, from asteroid impacts. Yeah. And statistically, you can't take a shovel full of Earth soil without having a bit of Martian soil in it. And so if there was life ever on Mars, we exchange it already with Earth and vice versa. There is an ice layer about a kilometer deep on Mars, and below that there's liquid water. So I think the chances, if we can get down to those layers, of finding, if not active life, remnants of earlier life when there were oceans, I think is a reasonable proposition. And one way to get at it is just to take the DNA, sequence it, and we could send it back to Earth in as little as 4.3 minutes and then recreate it in a lab here. And
in other words, send it back digitally rather than putting it in a bottle and flying it home.
Exactly. And we're actually doing a test with NASA this coming month. We were going to do it last month, but it got delayed due to the government shutdown. And we're going out to the Mojave Desert to a Mars test site. And we're going to be taking a soil sample, isolating the DNA, sequencing it, and sending it up to the cloud.
Has NASA found genetic material in its soil samples on Mars to date?
Absolutely not.
What's to send home?
It would be very surprising if from the surface of Mars there is any remnants of life due to the radiation and the constant exposure there, but deeper down into Mars, when one of the future craft will be able to drill beneath the surface, I think our odds of finding life goes up substantially.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about genetic science, synthetic life, and where it may take us with J. Craig Venter, pioneer in the first sequencing of the human genome. In 2010, synthetic life was his project. They did it, and there is much, much more to come here, he says, driving evolution in a radical directions. He writes about it, the implications, the history of the search, the effort, and the implications of it in his new book, Life at the Speed of Light, From the Double Helix to the Dawn of Digital Life. By the way, you can read an excerpt of that at our website, onpointradio.org. He's not just a thinker, he's a doer. He's got big laboratories that are hard at work on a lot of this, including the digital biological converter, the U.S. military research arm working with him and others to sort of zap life into a box or teleport it, even between planets, Mars and Earth. Craig Venter, can I just ask you, I think some people uninitiated may listen to this and feel like they're hearing a broadcast in the year 2050 or 2100. To hear that this is already happening, and you're talking of things that seem potentially imminent as well as longer-term things. How real is this world already? How soon do you expect it to become much more fully articulated, manifest, and start changing our lives?
Well, I think it is here and now. How much it changes our lives depends on the extent of new research around the world, but other governments, even the UK government, are investing billions of dollars in this new space. All this work started in the U.S., but could easily move the center to Europe or China if we don't invest more at the government level. But it is happening, and I think it's exciting new approaches to some of the biggest problems we've had. And we haven't solved the fuel problem. It's a long ways off. We're much closer to solving new foods, new vaccines, and new medicines. But I'm pretty optimistic about the future and that our technology will at least be part of the solution.
Our listeners are thinking about this and responding in all kinds of directions. Some of our feedback online, Craig Venter, Hennes writes, I'm not sure whether to be amazed by or terrified of a digital biological converter. Jason says, writes to us, I am a molecular biologist. So far, his vision frightens me. It's like the splitting of atoms. Sure, we can make electricity with it, but that also led to an arms race and Fukushima-type meltdowns that no one anticipated. Now he's talking about making synthetic life in your very own home. How long will it take for the first hacker to create a very dangerous microorganism? It's a small jump from there to fears of bioterrorism and all the rest. Craig Venter, what about it?
So we've been dealing with these questions ourselves before we ever did the first experiment. And I devote a fair amount of the book to talking about the ethical and societal impact. Mm-hmm. We asked for a review back in the late 90s, and this was taken on by Art Kaplan's group at the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. They published the results in Science in 1999. Since then, the Sloan Foundation has funded my institute along with MIT to look at the security questions. And then most recently is our announcement in 2010, President Obama asked his then new bioethics commission to take this on as their number one challenge. And I think they did an excellent report that you can find at the White House website. And I think everybody's sort of in the same place that this is really fantastic, very powerful new technology that we have to, as all new technology, be constantly concerned with the dual-use nature of it. And, for example, every synthetic DNA company in the U.S., and there's multitudes of them, screen all the requests for making small pieces of DNA against a list provided by the government of viruses and highly infectious bacteria so that nobody will inadvertently provide somebody with the ability to make those. In the devices that we're designing, and the first one will just be a simpler version on the market next year for the research community, we'll have multiple layers of security built in that makes it virtually impossible for somebody to redirect that box to do something other than what it was designed to do. But these are all challenges we have going forward. And as we see, there's a lot of software viruses, people trying to do harm to computer networks and computers. It's something we have to be vigilant about and constantly develop new resources to make sure that this does go in the positive to society column, not a negative.
One of our listeners reminds us, says Freeman Dyson says bioengineering will really take off when children are able to play with it at home. I mean, it sounds funny, but it goes to something very profound. You go there. You say our very understanding of life and what it is likely to be changed, is going to be changed here. It's been something forever that we received that was just laid out by evolution, by however you want to understand it, for us. Now it's going to be manipulated. Surely, over time, that it's kind of impossible for me to imagine a fully controlled path for that over endless time. I mean, we're going to end up in a world that is manipulated by us, that's not handed down by eons of evolution. How on earth do we keep some ballast under that and make sure it doesn't spin out of control? Whatever our best intentions and, you know, I mean, security measures sound almost laughable on the grand scale of time.
Well, let me remind you where we are in society, because almost nothing you eat as a plant or an animal is in a form that naturally evolved on this planet. It's all from pretty wild mixing of genomes over the last several centuries to get to what we have. For example, tomatoes, natural tomatoes, are small green things about the size of my thumb that taste very bitter. And even more disturbing with this whole question is a recent survey showed that about 50% of the public does not know that DNA is in tomatoes.
Yeah, I mean, I get that in the plants and the hybrids and so on. Absolutely. But this does unleash the capacity for much more radical changes than that, does it not?
Well, it gives, I don't know if they'll be more radical. They'll be more thoughtful and they'll be more controlled than random mixing of genomes, which when I think about that as a genome scientist, is a pretty disturbing kind of experiment that we've been doing with species for a very long time on this planet. I think trying to change evolution to produce sufficient food, clean water, and energy sources is something that society is now dependent on for its future. And so doing it in a thoughtful, intelligent, properly reviewed fashion is an essential part of our future.
Eric in Harvard, Massachusetts is calling. Eric, you're on the air with Craig Venter.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Craig. I was getting at just that. The evolution acts in a way that allows life to replicate and grow in a way that is actually sustainable. If we think that we can replace that with our intelligence at this point, where we've actually created such an unsustainable life pattern, I'm a little skeptical about that. But the other part of actually gets to that, which is that we know how to make bacteria that can make lipids for fuel, but the problem is that it can't be grown at scale. And so I'm not sure that, you know, just being able to tweak it a little bit is actually going to solve the problem.
Craig Venter?
Well, that was much more a comment than a question, but I think a lot of work out there shows Eric to be more pessimistic than I end up being, and we're already able to make pretty substantial changes in lipid production and photosynthesis. The challenge with fuel, and fuel sort of the wrong end of the equation, we've gone through multiple cycles of fuel crises that lead to then major efforts to try and come up with new biofuels. And then, then oil or coal prices drop radically and we wipe out new industries. And this has happened once again because of the discovery of natural gas from fracking. And, that sort of undercut the production of fuel. So the challenge is more one as a policy challenge of carbon tax and at what stage Do we recognize that we can't keep taking carbon out of the ground, burning it, and putting it in the atmosphere? We have to come up with other solutions. They're going to have trouble economically competing for a long time until we can dramatically change what these species do. The government's going to have to step in, governments around the world, to come up with some appropriate tax on carbon to force a change in our habits.
Let me pick up on an implicit question there. We've got another listener on Facebook. Alan writes, kind of relating to Eric's call. Alan says, we should not mess with the natural scheme of things. Science can't come up with a cure for cancer, and you're going to mess with the basic components of life. Not so, Alan writes. I mean, Eric puts it differently, but it's interesting. He said, you know, in effect, what you're saying is we're going to substitute human intelligence in the design of these synthetic life forms for evolution's eons of trial and error. And the implicit question is, isn't human intelligence a frail reed by comparison?
Well, let's go back to the numbers again of the three times as many people on the planet just in my lifetime.
I know we've got challenges, but that still doesn't increase our intelligence.
There is not time for natural evolution that takes billions of years to play a role in that. And the natural thing with evolution would be for our species to keep overpopulating, wiping out the resources until it disappears as a species. I'm hoping we're more intelligent than that. I think that's one of the challenges. Are we more intelligent, or are we just going to, you know, do what happens in the fishing industry? They fish out all the fish in the ocean until they're out of business.
But that's us overfishing.
We may do that.
That's us overpopulating. Why will we be more thoughtful in our synthetic life creation than we are in our fishing?
Well, I guess I know more thoughtful people in science than I do in fishing.
There's much embedded in that comment as well. Sarah in Waltham, Massachusetts. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Venter. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. You're on
the
air.
So I'm not entirely certain how your technique works, but I was curious how, you know, epigenetic factors are taken into account in your technique, or if they're not included in the organisms you make at all, and if that has any influence or any concerns.
What questions does an epigenetic view raise for you, Sarah? Like what?
So epigenetic factors are things that are passed down, you know, through mating. They're things that aren't really a part of the ATCG code. It's like methylation groups, but it can be things that end up affecting how certain molecules are made or proteins synthesized. And I was wondering how he takes into account if there's anything with that.
What's passed on beyond ATCG? Craig Venter. Thank you, Sarah. Craig?
So, Sarah, thank you for your thoughtful question. So epigenetics is, you know, getting a lot more attention lately as we turn inside the cell. The only thing I differ with your thoughts on is epigenetics still has its origins in the genetic code. It's obviously different in terms of complex mammalian life with what we get from the maternal egg and information that's carried in that. But that all originated itself in the genetic code. But it is important factors for how life is regulated. So with the synthetic life, with these simple bacterial cells, they still have pretty complex regulation from the proteins that are produced from the chaperonins. And a key part that I talk about in the book is the protein world and how the DNA codes not only for the linear structure of the proteins, but built into that coding is the information of how fast they fold, what they fold into, what their function is, and even what's called the N rule of degradation, where the N-terminal amino acid determines how fast that protein lasts, whether it's seconds to minutes to hours. But all our proteins are constantly undergoing degradation and resynthesis from the genome. If you take the DNA out of any cell, the cell dies pretty rapidly. We're an information-based system. Of course, the proteins that exist in the cell are absolutely essential for being able to initially read that genetic code. But that's something that going back to the early 60s, the Marshall Nuremberg and Gobain Khurana work on working out how the triplet code coded for proteins. They did all this in cell-free environments with using small pieces of synthetic DNA to produce proteins in a cell-free world. So we're getting more and more understanding of that complexity in a way, starting with just the genetic code. If you get a living cell from it, from the design, that's implicit in there, and you do get that information. But it's important for the long-term understanding of particularly human health to understand these regulatory processes.
Sarah, thank you so much. Craig Venter, we just have a minute left here. You talk about the digital age of biology. You say that in it, our notions of what we mean by the natural environment will change as the technology becomes more widespread. Change how? Is it going to be one big version of SimCity out there with us tapping away on a keyboard?
Well, I think the most important thing, and you touched on this earlier, it changes the concept and our understanding of life. And if we understand life as a DNA software system, it changes perhaps how we think, how we relate to all the other species on the planet. And if we can harness that software for the benefit of humanity, these are wonderful opportunities.
Ladies and gentlemen, hold on to your hats. That is some frontier being described. J. Craig Venter writes about it. It's history and the future in life at the speed of light, from the double helix to the dawn of life. Craig Venter, thank you very much for being with us from San Diego today.
My pleasure.
By the way, his own DNA, it's out there in the form of electromagnetic waves. He writes, carrying my genetic information far beyond Earth, rippling out into space, borne upon waves, my life now moves at the speed of light. So other planets, other solar systems, here he comes. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.